Good afternoon. It is 3:18. We are on the record. House Labor and Commerce, Room 124, Friday, April 14th. Don't forget to do your taxes this weekend. Please turn off your cell phones or turn them down to silent. Present, we have Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Co-Chair Wohl, and myself, Chair Keto. We have a quorum. All members present to conduct business. Support staff today are Caitlin Ellis, our recording secretary, and Ben Manley over on the LIO moderator station. We've got three bills on the agenda today, and we are actually going to end up not moving any of them. We've got additional information to try and pull in and collect. So House Bill 209, Product Warranties and Required Updates. House Bill 195, Ensures Use of Credit History Scores. And House Bill 83, Teachers and Public Employee Retirement Plans, has been removed. We're still awaiting the committee substitute, and we will have that bill hopefully ready by Monday. So that bill is removed, and we have two items on the agenda now. We will bring House Bill 209 before the committee, Product Warranties and Required Updates. And if my staff, Bianca Carpinetti, can come up and provide the introduction of the bill.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bianca Carpinetti, staff to Representative Keto. House Bill 209, Product Warranties and Required Updates, provides protections for small businesses and consumers in Alaska's heavy equipment market. Our state's remote work sites and transportation challenges, coupled with high shipping costs, often result in high costs to local dealers and distributors when delivering warranty and update services for a manufacturer's defective or deficient product. Many of these services are not reimbursed by the manufacturers who require this work. This results in our local businesses or their customers absorbing expenses for shipping, transportation, and labor that should be paid by the company that manufactures the defective or deficient product, provides the warranty, and requires the updates. As I said, remote rural work sites, where no approved warranty providers are available, present a challenge. This issue arises when one party in a contract, in this case the local vendor, lacks the ability to negotiate effectively with the other party, in this case the larger company, the manufacturer. Provisions should exist in Alaska law that ensure Alaska's vendors and consumers are truly protected by fair warranty contracts and that the spirit of the warranty to fix what is defective is honored. Government can support an environment where businesses and commerce can thrive. That's the goal of this bill. It's about contractual rights between parties providing protection for Alaska's vendors and consumers. I'd also like to note that HB 209 closely tracks the statute governing marine and motorized recreational products, AS 4527-100. That statute passed the Alaska legislature unanimously in 2009 as SB 173. To my knowledge, the statute has not generated difficulties or unintended consequences in the intervening 8 years, and given that successful track record, it seemed prudent to take advantage of legislation that was tried and true in Alaska. HB 209 also includes what all referred to as a lemon law provision. Lemon laws originated with automotive vehicles. These are regulations meant to protect consumers in the event that they purchase a defective vehicle. Alaska's lemon law protecting motor vehicles is AS 4545-300, which is closely analogous to the lemon law provision in 209 in front of you. With that introduction of the issues at hand and the intent of the bill, I'd like to offer a brief discussion of the provisions in the bill itself. So Section 1 is actually broken down into a number of subsections, so I'll begin with sort of a subsectional analysis. 4545, 772 through 776, these sections generally protect the manufacturer's interest by ensuring that dealers comply with standard warranty practices. 4545-777 addresses required service reimbursement, and it establishes the minimum compensation for work performed by a dealer on behalf of a manufacturer. For example, it specifies the minimum rate, the established customer hourly rate, and a time for labor costs. It also requires the manufacturer to pay for transportation and lodging costs if the dealer has to send an employee to the field to perform the work. Sections 778 through 779 deal with products and parts needed for repairs or services, including how these are reimbursed and where they're delivered. Sections 780 and 781 address how to respond to a claim, outlining the timeline and process for a manufacturer to respond to a claim, either by paying or disapproving it. And the intent in this section is to limit the dealer's obligation to carry the manufacturer's cost of warranty repairs beyond a reasonable period. The repairs required is outlined in 782. This also, similar to many of the previous provisions, is based on the ATV and marine statute, and the purpose is to ensure that the warranty coverage will apply if a customer properly reports a covered defect during the warranty period, even if the actual warranty work takes place at a later time. The next sections, 783 and 784, is where you find the sort of the lemon law provisions in 209, both how the provision works and how consumers make a claim under the provision. As I mentioned, marine products and ATVs are protected, while motor vehicles have lemon law protections under 45-45-300. Heavy equipment at this time does not have the same protection in Alaska. So in the absence of statutory protections, dealers in Alaska can find themselves in three-way negotiations with manufacturers and customers about the return or replacement of defective equipment. And in these situations, a dealer may have to buy back failing equipment from a customer or substitute other equipment. 785 does outline the exceptions to this provision in that the manufacturer is not liable for what I'll refer to as user error. So if a user alters or abuses a piece of equipment, the manufacturer is not required to the piece is not under warranty if it's if the damage is a result of alteration or abuse. 786 works in conjunction with the Lemon Law provision by creating a rebuttable presumption in order to define what is considered reasonable attempts at repairing a defective or deficient product. 787 and 788 establish which products apply here and what qualifies as warranty service. That concludes the provisions, or sorry, the subsections in Section 1. The remaining sections 2 and 3 of the bill cover definitions. 4 adds the violations of this provisions to unfair methods of competition and unfair or deceptive acts or practices found in 4550-471, our consumer protection statute. And then Section 5 establishes the applicability of this act after its effective date. And I'd just like to note that this act is not retroactive, so it applies to new contracts. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my prepared remarks to the committee. I'm happy to take questions from members, though I might need to call on our legal experts, Ms. Franklin and Mr. Seward, who are both online. I would also add that we have individuals associated with both local vendors and machinery manufacturers present for invited testimony, if the chair prefers to hear their remarks first.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Carpinetti? We do have invited testimony. I think I'd like to try and have some of that to get some of the issues out on the table. Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. And first up for invited testimony, I'd like to ask Ken Gerondale. So, Ken, can you place your name, affiliation on the record, and provide your testimony, please?
Okay, my name is Ken Gerondale. I'm calling from Anchorage. I'm the owner of Construction Machinery Industrial and have been involved in this bill since it was introduced.
Okay, thank you. And do you have some comments you'd like to provide on the record regarding the bill?
Yes, I would. I'd like to offer some practical feedback. I was born in Alaska, and my grandfather was involved in construction going back many years. I've operated equipment and retired from the operating engineers when I was 27 years old, and since that time I've been involved in marketing heavy equipment, and then I've started my own business in 1985. Construction Machinery Industrial today is a fairly significant supplier of heavy equipment into the oil patch as well as mining and general contracting. One thing, part of this bill, the reason that I've been working on it is there's a big disparity in the state of Alaska between small contractors and large contractors. And what I have found in distributing equipment in Alaska is the large contractors and large miners have the ability on their own when they receive a piece of equipment that does not operate the way it's designed, either from a lemon law standpoint or the manufacturers having a hard time coming up with updates and repairing as far as warranties, the large contractor and large mine have very little problems in negotiating with both the dealer and the manufacturer to repair that equipment and make it right. Or if it can't be, forcing the dealer and forcing the manufacturer to buy it back. To me, this bill mainly supports the small user of heavy equipment in the state of Alaska that normally do not have a large voice. Now, there are a lot of reputable dealers in this state, and I consider CMI one of them. And I can tell you in the last 12 months, we have probably purchased back maybe 5 or 6 pieces of equipment that did not operate properly. And of the 5 or 6 that we purchased back, half of them were from small contractors. As a strategy and a way we've been in business, we take care of the people we sell to. At the same time, my experience going back 30 years, there have been other distributors or manufacturers from outside Alaska where the small and sometimes the large user of heavy equipment does not have the protection to negotiate or force or get a piece of equipment repaired. And in Alaska, and as all of us know, you overlay Alaska or the continental U.S., we go coast to coast, north to south, and it is very expensive for both dealers and manufacturers to take care of their equipment. So from my standpoint, that is the background of this bill. I'd just like to throw out a couple instances. One instance that CMI was directly involved, we sold 3 new pieces of equipment to Pogo Mine approximately about a year ago. They were Skyjack, manufactured by Skyjack, a Canadian company. We'd represented them for years. The equipment went up to Pogo, working in a very, very tough situation, working underground with explosives and consumables. The 3 light pieces of equipment did not operate per the design and were considered dangerous from the users of the equipment underground. It took us months and months to negotiate with the manufacturer, the Canadian manufacturer, to repair the machines. In fact, what we ended up having to do is we ended up buying the 3 pieces back. We got the manufacturer to finally reimburse our warranty cost under the condition that we didn't, under their condition to us, that they didn't want to ever do business with CMI, again, as far as selling heavy equipment. That was fine with us. Another instance would be a small miner in the Talkeetna area, Goldorado. We sold him a used Volvo excavator. That Volvo excavator got up in the Talkeetna Mountains where he mined as well as he did support work for the Alaska Railroad and just had a number of failures. It just was not a good situation. And we in turn worked with Todd and ended up buying that piece of equipment back and with no condition of buying another piece or anything like that. And within 6 months, he decided to buy another piece of equipment from us. He bought a different brand, and he's a happy customer. But my point to this and where I'm coming from is there is not existing protection in Alaska for large or small users of heavy equipment. And I will say this. Don't let any manufacturer tell you that they do not have warranty problems and that they do not live up to their warranty responsibilities. Because in my experience, that just isn't the case. They all do, and I don't even mind telling you that the manufacturers that we represent have a hard time from time to time. But we're a large enough dealer that we can force the initiative and end up taking care of the customer. That's what I got to say.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gerondale. We've got a couple of questions, Representative Josephson and then Representative Birch.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Gerondale, I've learned that there are opportunities that arise between the contracting parties to renegotiate the contracts. And I'm wondering if you've, utilized those opportunities and bargained aggressively or how that's worked. Or is it your position that the original manufacturer is always going to be in a preferred economic position? If you could answer those questions.
Sure. As a mode of staying in business in Alaska, both upturns and downturns, we aggressively pursue negotiating with the manufacturers that we work with in supporting the equipment when there are problems. And believe me, you do run into problems. They're not all trouble-free. And we use that now. Again, what I feel this bill will do, I don't feel this bill is going to cause any lawsuits. It's not going to cause an increase in price. It's not going to cause anything like that. It's going to force the owner of the equipment. It's going to force the dealer who sold the equipment or the manufacturer who sold it direct, and there's nobody in the middle. It's going to force everybody to negotiate and come up and solve the problem. And if you notice in this bill, it's not retroactive. So as an example, CMI, who's had signed contracts for many, many years with our manufacturers, it isn't really going to help us that much as a new dealer who signs a new contract. But what it's going to do, it's going to put a delta out there. It's going to put a line in the sand that CMI, that I can go back to Volvo or I can go back to Hitachi or and say, look, this is state law. You guys have to live up to this commitment. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my background as far as that goes.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerondale, I guess it's an interesting bill in that you're an Alaska company, and so, you know, from a starting point, you know, one might think you'd have the sympathies of fellow Alaskans, but I also know you're a very significant company. It seems like you would have a lot of sort of economic power relative to the out-of-state manufacturer that I'm curious about. And I guess I'm also just wondering about the role of the legislature and whether we should be intervening in these sorts of contracts. I take, for example, virtually everything is shipped to Alaska, and there must be 1,000 negotiations on everything from heads of lettuce to bicycles about who pays shipment costs and who bears those. And I assume that, I mean, we're not generally asked to negotiate or intervene in those, and I'm just wondering why we're necessary.
Well, yeah, to answer your question, I would just like to say from my experience that it is going to be very helpful for the end user of heavy equipment in Alaska to have a law like this on the books, because then they can go back to that manufacturer or go back to that dealer and make sure that they do what they said they're going to do, provide a reasonably reliable piece of equipment with a certain warranty that's written down. We're not asking the legislature to have any decision on that warranty. We're asking for something on the books that end user can say, hey, this, we just want you to live by the rules and follow the law and give us what you said you were going to give us. Because I'll use this as an experience. Let's just say we had a small home builder in Sitka, and he went out and bought one of these Skyjack forklifts for $110,000, leveraged the hell out of himself, and he's got those big payments, and the thing just fell apart, and he couldn't get it fixed, and he bought it from a dealer in Seattle. What leverage do we have today that small home builder working, trying to make a living in Sitka, is going to have trying to deal with a dealer in Seattle or even a dealer in Anchorage, for that matter, a dealer in Juneau, unless there is the financial wherewithal of that dealer to want to solve that problem. That manufacturer, that user, he's going to demand that a dealer in Seattle or a manufacturer in Canada buy back that piece of equipment for $120,000. I can honestly tell you it just will not happen. There's just no support for that.
Thank you, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in looking through this, I'm a little uncomfortable with the, you know, I mean, it strikes me that the state of Alaska is kind of inserting itself, if you will, between a relationship between a dealer and a manufacturer here. And as an example, requires the manufacturer to pay for transportation and lodging costs that the dealer has to send an employee to the field to perform the work. So, I mean, I don't know about a dozer, but if somebody buys a, some sort of a Ford SUV in Anchorage and flies it to Kotzebue and lands it up there, I mean, I don't know that that customer is, it's realistic that that customer is going to expect it to be all on the on Ford to basically fly somebody to Kotzebue to fix it. And off in the analogy, but it just seems like, you know, particularly with construction equipment, it gets into a really remote location. And just to kind of unilaterally say that the manufacturer's got to pick up the tab for transportation, lodging, and costs, I can understand why you buy good equipment, and I know you guys sell good equipment, and I know you back it up. But I'm just trying to get my head around the state kind of intervening here between, you know, what is arguably a contract between the dealer, you know, whomever, and the manufacturer. If you could speak to that for a minute.
Sure. And, you know, that is a very good question. That's a very good question. And we sell a lot of equipment to the state of Alaska. And the state of Alaska contract calls for the manufacturer dealer to support that equipment wherever it is. It can be in Naknek, it can be in Kotzebue. When we sell equipment directly to the city of Kotzebue, that warranty includes flying up there and working on it and repairing it. That is part of our existing warranty programs for the products that we have. Now, having said that, there are some manufacturers that don't provide that level of support. And in that case, again, a large dealer like CMI or NC Machinery, if they choose, or whatever, can force the manufacturer to reimburse and help us fix that piece of equipment. Again, the problem is, for a small dealer that doesn't have the financial wherewithal, or for that fellow in Kotzebue who got a good buy and bought a brand new piece of equipment in Seattle and asked for the Seattle dealer where he bought it to fly somebody up and fix it, it's just not going to happen. It is a normal course of business with most of your dealers and the manufacturers that have dealers in Alaska that they have to fix it on site. And in those areas where, say, you don't get reimbursed the airfare or something like that, that is normally it's normally part of the purchase contract on the front end. But I would say, as far as CMI goes, and that's the only thing I can guarantee you, is 90 to 95% of the equipment we sell out in the bush, we fix it. We have to fix it. And the end user does not have to pay for all the travel time or expense of getting there.
So this doesn't change that. Follow up. This doesn't change that, and if I understand what you're saying, and that you're simply looking out for smaller dealers or the kind of the one-offs or something, but it doesn't adversely impact or directly impact either NC machine or, you know, a large operator like yourself or NC.
No, I would say not. That's part of us doing business. Talk to maybe some of your constituents that are in the contracting business and buy a new piece of equipment. It is expected, and it should be part of the purchase contract, that if it needs repair, the warranty as far as travel expense has to be paid, because the consumer can't absorb that. And sometimes it gets to be very expensive.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you. I'm having some questions, too, as to where and why the state would be involved in this. But my question really is this. So say something like this does pass, and it's a little more onerous on the manufacturer. To your knowledge, is there anything that's going to preclude the manufacturer from saying, well, Any equipment we sell to the state of Alaska will not have a warranty on it.
I do not know a single instance of a manufacturer that would do that. I can also tell you, if a manufacturer builds poor product and doesn't have the confidence in that product, and he knows, if he knows he sends it out to the bush or sends it to some place that is going to be expensive to support, he may choose not to sell it for that specific reason. But I do not know of any bona fide quality manufacturer right now that's doing business in Alaska would quit doing business in Alaska because we're asking them to uphold the warranty that they provide. Just because our state goes coast to coast and north to south doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the same warranty coverage as a Continental 48.
Follow up. You don't think that there's any difference between working in rural Alaska as opposed to one of the lower 48 states?
Well, I think there's a lot of difference, and that's why, and that's exactly why it's so important to have something on the books to protect, whether it's a small village community out in the bush that buys crushers from us or loaders, and whoever sells to them and provides new equipment, and there's a warranty behind it, there should be the support to support that equipment wherever it is.
Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions for Mr. Gerondale. So if I understand this correctly, you're saying that some of the larger mines can successfully negotiate with the manufacturers because of their size, and that your company is at times in that same category. Let me ask you this. Are you guys big enough to get the same sort of negotiating power as the large mines, or is that what you're striving for with this bill?
No, that's not what I'm striving for. We now have that with the manufacturers we represent. I don't think this bill will change the coverage that we have from the manufacturers we represent. The one area that there's a possible difference is the Lemon Law portion of this bill when it comes to providing a piece of equipment that just doesn't operate in because of design. Like if anybody here is familiar with Tier 4 Interim, which is emission control for Tier 4 Interim, or have not proved to be reliable and have been a big problem. And 80% of our buybacks has been because of the design of Tier 4 Interim, as other manufacturers. Now, we have been fully supported by our manufacturers when we have come to solve that problem, but that is a good example.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if your company is successfully negotiating this, unlike an automobile where I have to buy from a dealer, I can't buy it directly from Ford, let's say, there's people, smaller companies in Alaska that can buy directly from the manufacturer. Is that what's going on? And those are the guys that are getting used? Is that the case?
Did I get cut off?
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
Mr. Gerondale, no. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, thanks.
Did you hit a question?
I know I did, and I'm sorry we were cut off there for a second.
Go ahead. Okay, let me repeat it. So if I understand it, your company is large enough that you can successfully negotiate with the manufacturers, but there's smaller companies or individuals that buy equipment directly from the manufacturer. Unlike a car where I have to go through a dealer, I could buy a piece of equipment from John Deere or something like that. Is that what we're looking to protect?
Yes, or let's just say a generator or any type of heavy piece of equipment that you could buy directly from a manufacturer or even a dealer outside of Alaska and ship direct to your location in western Alaska or on the Aleutian chain.
Okay. All right, I'm just trying to understand it.
We
are sure.
Other invited testifiers.
Okay, okay.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gerondale, I just want to really get to the essence of this. What I'm not hearing is that people are in breach of contract, because if they were in breach of contract, any lawyer could be employed and sue for breach of contract. So you're not saying that Kabada guaranteed in the fine print that if somebody were in a remote mining site, let's say Nyack, which is I think the YK Delta.
This is Ken Gerondale again. Is somebody trying to ask me a question?
Yes. Can you hear us, Ken? 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 We can hear you fine. It doesn't sound like you're hearing us.
I'm afraid I can't hear anybody.
Okay.
Okay.
Ken, perhaps you can try and call back in. We do have other people that will be invited to testify, and if you can be called back in, if you can hear me. Ken?
Okay, I can hear you there.
Okay. We might be having a little trouble with your connection. If you could call back in and then maybe be available for questions, we're going to move on to some other invited testimony, and then we'll try and get back to you for some questions if they come up again.
Perfect. I'll call back in. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gerondale. Next for invited testimony, we have John McKinnon online. Mr. McKinnon, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John McKinnon. I'm the Executive Director of the Associated General Contractors of Alaska. We are a construction trade association representing around 640 Alaska businesses involved in the construction industry. Of those 640, about half are contractors, half are suppliers and associates to the construction industry. And just for full disclosure, CMI is one of our members, as are four or five other major equipment dealers in the state. I do support this. Our association does support this bill. There have been a number of instances that were brought to my attention where smaller contractors were the unwelcome recipients of poor service as a result of warranty issues or, as Mr. Gerondale referred to it, equipment that failed to perform as promised. When I sent this out, it was last year's version of the bill, sent this out to my membership, heard back from a couple of contractors some details that they had that this would have alleviated a lot of the issue that they had, a lot of the poor performance. I also heard from one of the small dealers that definitely supports this, and you know, from my understanding, equipment dealers are unwilling because of fear of concern that the suppliers might I don't want to say cut them off, but there's a fear of retribution at times from the suppliers. That if a dealer were to support this, that it could impact them. You know, dealers like CMI, they're a big business, but the equipment they sell from, like Hitachi and those, they are order of magnitude or more larger. So even though CMI is big and exerts leverage, the big manufacturers are considerably larger. So we do support this bill, and I think it's good for the industry as a whole.
Thank you, Mr. McKinnon. Questions, Representative Knopp.
John, good to hear from you. So a couple questions, John, if the chair will allow me here. First question, I'm not aware up here of any end user that gets to buy Factory Direct. Are you, and you know anybody's buying CAT or Volvo, Hitachi from Factory?
No. Big manufacturers are dealing through distributors and licensed retailers like CMI or NC Machinery. Okay. I don't know of anyone that would be able to buy Factory Direct.
Right. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
They would be able to buy. Excuse me, through the chair, they would be able to buy from dealers outside the state. You know, oftentimes they can save money, or they can buy you know, aftermarket products and but out of state, but. No, big equipment is sold through licensed dealers within the state.
So, thank you, John. Yeah, and I'm aware of that. And so when that piece of equipment comes, regardless of which dealer it's bought through, our dealers will still have an obligation for the warranty work on that. That's part of their contractual. Is that fair to say?
That That is correct.
Okay. So, John, when them dealers pick up a new product line, they are also aware of the warranty and the contract of that manufacturer at that time, are they not, John?
That is correct. When they pick up a product line, they might be picking up some potential liabilities out there.
Okay. So then I just want to ask you, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. I'm going to follow up here. So I got to tell you, John, how this thing reads to me is not a consumer protection bill, but a dealer protection bill. And there's some stuff in it I like, but there's some stuff that, you know, I'm going to give you an example here. Manufacturer to pay for transportation and lodging costs, you know, I think that's almost an unrealistic expectation in a state this size. I have a little trouble with that one. And then the other one, John, is to pay a dealer full retail for that part off the shelf. If a dealer is stocking them parts because they're typically a high-use item, and the manufacturer is sending it right back there, I'm not quite sure that, you know, it's a warranty thing, so they're having to replace it for nothing anyway. Instead of cost, you're wanting full retail. So there's some components of the bill I'm not particularly like. But I guess what I want to ask you, one last final question, is a gentleman the last gentleman just testified, CMI, he talked about the Tier 4 stuff, and I know it's a problem. I'm wondering, is that the biggest bulk of the warranty stuff we're seeing having to perform out there?
You know, through the chair, Representative, I can't answer that one. Okay. I'm not familiar with many of the details on these warranty issues. Okay. I do know of a number that have been failure to perform as specified or as promised in the literature.
Okay.
But the Tier 4, you know, those are still at work, at least for a period of time. They were a work in progress, and there was a lot of little kinks to be ironed out in them.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. McKinnon? Thank you for your testimony, John.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Appreciate you calling in. And next on invited testimony, we have George Whitaker with CNH Industrial. Mr. Whitaker, can you provide or place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is George Whitaker, and I work for CNH Industrial. We're the manufacturers of Case IH and New Holland Agricultural Equipment and Case and New Holland Construction Equipment. We have 7 dealers located in Alaska, and they are located in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Wasilla, and Palmer. And I'd like to start off by saying that we think the concerns called out in HB 209 are best addressed between dealers and suppliers, and I'll go into some detail on that. I'd also like to comment that product support, warranty delivery, warranty reimbursement is a fast-changing environment for suppliers and dealers alike, especially as we see new smart products, new technologies emerge. There's no question that the world of warranty is going to change dramatically over the next 3 to 5 years. We strongly believe that we, working with our dealers, are best suited to plot the course forward without legislative intervention. There's a number of paragraphs in the bill that I would like to speak to, perhaps in more granular detail than the committee would like, but I'll give my best to keep us out of the weeds. The first two paragraphs I'd like to address speak to our general comment in letters that I've sent to the committee and earlier this week and then the email last night about ambiguous language. And if I could, on page 2 of the bill, line 20, paragraph 775, restrictions not allowed. This paragraph really caught our eye, especially in terms of the ambiguous language. Should a dispute arise between a dealer and a supplier, the paragraph is really going to provide some extremely difficult and likewise costly scenarios for the parties. The question is going to be, what exactly do we mean by the words restrictions that impair a dealer's ability to satisfy the required service? So words like restrictions could mean anything to a plaintiff's attorney, if you will, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm speaking from experience, but a plaintiff's attorney could be the method in which a part was ordered, or the words in which a service manual, or the form and manner of training that a dealer technician received from a supplier, just to name a few. So the intent of this paragraph appears to be the suppliers must follow the law, which in fact we do. However, the paragraph seems to be clearly in need of a more clear and unambiguous language that reduces the potential to head down unnecessarily expensive and time-consuming path should a dispute arise. The next paragraph is 776, line 25, standard claim procedures. Seems to be in conflict with 776, but essentially there's no real standard, industry standard form for warranty claims. Our process is invariably different from in form and function from Caterpillar's and theirs from John Deere's and different other suppliers of chainsaws and ATVs and other products that are would be covered under this bill. So like the prior paragraph, it seems to be absent of an industry standard. You know, this is an ambiguous paragraph. It also lends itself to unnecessarily expensive and time-consuming process should a dispute arise between dealers and suppliers. Starting on page 2 and kind of wrapping around to page 3, paragraph 777, service required reimbursement. Seems to be an apples and oranges type of comparison. So you say you've got the manufacturer shall pay the dealer at a rate not less than the highest of the following. And there's three choices here. The rate the dealer distributor customarily pays for customer work. So that's known as the posted dealer rate, and that's very clear. But then you get into the manufacturer's flat rate, which is not a typically a dollar value, that's a time value. So ordinarily you would multiply 1 times paragraph 2 and you would have a reimbursement amount that the dealer is to receive. And then the third one is a flat rate established by a nationally recognized industry consultant. Private published labor rate manuals may exist in the auto industry, but if they exist in construction equipment there anymore, they're very hard to find. And if you do find them, they're typically used for providing productivity analysis for dealer technicians or job quotations and what have you, but certainly not for warranty purposes. I also want to point out that the dealer posted labor rate obviously varies from dealer to dealer. The rate is derived locally by the dealer without the manufacturer's input, if you will. Without regard to the supplier, and the rate is based on market serve, the investment the dealer's made, the wages they pay, their position in the marketplace, and so on. So two dealers representing the same brand will invariably have different posted labor rates. As I said, manufacturers don't typically dictate labor rates to the dealers. The next couple of paragraphs I'd like to focus on are really how cost inevitably finds the consumer, and I think it will even speak to some of the questions we're asked about how manufacturers might change warranty and how cost could be passed on to consumers through enhanced warranty reimbursement. So, again, on page 3, paragraph C, line 11, payment under this section must include payment for cleanup, preparation, diagnostics, disassembly, repair, and assembly, and so forth. So, okay, so if we isolate the words cleanup, preparation, testing, final cleaning, these are unaccountable and unaudible activities by the dealer. So some jobs will have a lot, some jobs will have a little, but the incremental administrative cost will be substantial. So this paragraph leads to the discussion about the so-called unreimbursed costs and how they get paid. And I don't want to drag you too deep in the weeds here, but essentially the dealer, a high-performing dealer, perhaps a CMI or other large successful dealers in the state, they capture those costs, they know what they are, and they typically build those costs into the price of the cost of the machine, if you will, when they go to establish a selling price to the consumer, right? So then they recover those costs when they sell the machine. And they're effectively not unreimbursed costs. They're the fact that customer pays the costs, just like customers ultimately pay for all costs for the dealership plus the profit for the business. So it's a cost that you might call, and I think the gentleman from the dealership called it a cost of doing business, and that's in fact what it is. So if the supplier were to be handed these costs, as is proposed in the bill, a similar thing would happen. There'd be two things that certainly would happen. One, the supplier would see higher warranty costs and then would offset that cost by raising the price of the equipment sold into dealers in Alaska, or a surcharge would be put on the products shipped to Alaska to cover these costs. So at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, the customer ends up paying these costs through the price of the equipment. As we move to paragraph D, the bill states in addition to payment, the manufacturer will pay a minimum of 1 hour of labor rate for the administration of a warranty claim. And as you may know or may have heard, you know, obviously dealers have various people in their business that help keep the trains running. So you've got direct folks that produce revenue, and you've got indirects who help things happen in the business. So all those people there are there to help technicians continue to work effectively, efficiently, and generating income. The cost of all those people is calculated into the dealer shop labor rate, and it should be treated just like the other departments of the dealership that have administrative costs. So if the state says, Mr. Dealer, transfer this cost to the supplier, the fact of the matter is suppliers will in turn transfer that cost back to the dealer through the price of increase or through a surcharge, and ultimately the customer will pay for that hour of warranty administration as he does today. If you move to line 17, paragraph E, the manufacturer shall reimburse the dealer for transportation and lodging, and I think we talked about this. I will say from personal experience, working in some areas of large geography, Texas as an example. In most cases, you'll find in Texas, if the dealer wants to sell a product to a customer whom they know is taking the product beyond a certain radius or into a largely remote area, that they have a conversation with the customer, and the customer understands that he'll have some financial responsibility for travel time to conduct warranty and service. So the customer in Prudhoe Bay who's got an excavator can't expect the same type of cost structure for warranty that does a customer in Anchorage or Fairbanks or what have you. So, and that customer in turn builds that cost into his cost of doing business. So again, there's some incremental cost of being a long way from support infrastructure, and those customers tend to understand that and build that into their cost of doing business.
Mr. Whitaker?
Yes, sir.
So can you let me know how much longer you think you might have for your testimony? We do have other people that are invited.
Okay. Well, I can wrap it up very quickly in that case. A couple points. Oh, one additional point on the lemon law side that doesn't seem to appear to be on the bill, and that is there may be cases where a supplier just says, you know what, this application does not work for our machine. The dealer mentioned the skyjack lifts in a mining condition. We've had excavators in salt conditions or in very tough marble quarry mining conditions, and they said, you know, we weren't made aware of the conditions this machine was going into. Rather than a refund or replace, we just simply want to refund, and so we'd like to just, as a courtesy, walk away from the deal and refund the customer's money. And it doesn't seem that the bill has coverage for that option for the manufacturer. And the final thing is very broad definition: equipment, tools, and motor vehicles. Tools and equipment, that indicates hand tools, chainsaws, utility vehicles, ATVs. So it would appear that a dealer who sells a Kubota tractor that's used in the Matsu Valley for farming, who also would sell that same model tractor with a backhoe in Anchorage for light construction, would be treating customers, suppliers, and the product differently between the two. So I'm sorry for going on a little bit long, but I'll be happy to try to take questions.
Okay, thank you. We do have a question. Representative Justin, then Birch, and then Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Whitaker. I guess the first thing I'm curious about is it's my understanding that the manufacturers who you broadly represent and the dealer or distributor, that there's an opportunity for negotiation that occurs. And I'm wondering if you can give an example of something the manufacturers have conceded in a previous negotiation.
Well, when you refer to an opportunity for negotiation, are you talking about a dealer agreement, or are you talking about a failed machine warranty experience?
I'm talking about a dealer agreement. So I'm talking about the birth of a new set of negotiations, much like a union would negotiate with with management. Not that that's a parallel here, but I'm told that there are actual meetings where there's a big conference table and there's offer and acceptance made.
Well, the way that our dealer agreement is structured is we have a standard dealer agreement. And why do we do that? Because in many cases the law says you're going to have to treat all dealers the same. Right, same terms, same pricing, no biases towards size. You may have some ability to change price based on volumes and so forth, but basically a standard dealer agreement. And then below that, if you will, a lot of operating items are negotiated. In the case of a warranty, if there's a major failure and it's a critical customer or the dealer feels that the customer warrants some cooperation, we'll certainly get in and negotiate that with the customer and the dealer in a three-party fashion. And then specific to the dealer agreement, there may be some areas unique to Alaska, call it trade areas or other types of things that are very unique, that we would negotiate through amendments and addendums to the contract. By and large, it's a standard contract that all dealers are offered and signed across all 50 states.
I'll follow up.
I guess one thing that would help me, Mr. Whitaker, is we've heard a lot about your side and the dealer distributor side. What does the customer think is going on? I mean, if I buy a piece of heavy equipment for my farm in the Matsu Valley and it doesn't work, presumably there's something written down that says either the distributor on the Parks Highway that's sort of the thoroughfare through the Matsu Valley that sold me the piece of equipment is responsible and I can rely on that because that's my contract with the distributor, or that there's a contract that says no, it's someone in in Moline, Illinois, working for John Deere that is responsible. And I guess what I'm asking is, what I'm not hearing is that there's a contract dispute. Am I right about that? There's no contract dispute. There must be a lawsuit somewhere going on. There's no dispute about duty. That's what contracts are about. It's duty. This bill is about moving duty from one side to the other. Is that your understanding?
Correct. So, I wouldn't say duty so much as perhaps cost of execution. So the first line is always the dealer. The dealer sold the tractor or it was sold into his area of responsibility, and he is obliged to do the warranty work or do the service work on that machine. If the dealer finally runs out of rope and says, I've done everything I can, then obviously then the company will step in and bring an expert in or make a swap or do whatever is necessary to get right with the customer. So I don't think there's an effort to shift duty so much as shift cost in this case.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question, sir, on how it works as far as you mentioned warranty and service type work. I know if you go to a car dealer, you know, if you buy a Honda, you take it back to the Honda dealer, and they charge you, you know, $130 an hour for maintenance on routine stuff. But if you have a warranty item, it's my understanding that that same dealer has a contract of one sort or another with the supplier, with, you know, with Honda Direct, that maybe guarantees them some work at a reduced rate. And so, I mean, it is kind of a, I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand that relationship. So if it's a bulldozer from a supplier to the dealer, does a dealer actually secure some guaranteed line of work? And if so, is that typically a pretty significant percentage of the work that dealer has to doing warranty and service work related to that equipment?
Well, in our case, and many manufacturers are different, but in our case, if warranty work comes back to the shop, we reimburse the dealer at his retail rate, his walk-in customer rate for labor, and then we reimburse the dealer his cost plus for parts. And why do we do that? Because we also use warranty as an incentive to the dealer to make investments in tools and training to give best-in-class service. And so it's one way of helping the dealer to make those investments, right? So how much of the dealer's shop work, total revenue in a service shop, is warranty? There's a big variance there. It depends on the park of machines that the dealer has established. That depends how well and effectively they market their service department. There's no set guarantee, but obviously the more machines you sell, the more warranty work you generate. And, of course, the shop is, on a percentage basis, typically the most profitable area of a dealership operation, be it automotive or construction machinery.
Okay, so follow up. So a provision that says a manufacturer shall reimburse a dealer or distributor at the current manufacturer's full suggested retail price for covered products in the dealer's inventory, that doesn't seem out of line to you? I mean, is that kind of reasonable?
The interesting thing about our business is you have majors and you have, call it, minors. The majors, that would not be out of line. Minors would be difficult, probably. And then you have some variations. I know that, you know, Caterpillar has a different situation, and John Deere may have a different situation as well. But like I said there's no real standards. But in terms of reimbursing a dealer for at his retail labor rate for labor, it's not terribly out of line. No.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitaker, thanks for your testimony, and I just have a couple questions. You just mentioned majors and minors. Are you talking about manufacturers or dealers?
I'm not talking about manufacturers.
Okay.
So we might be considered a full-line manufacturer of construction equipment, whereas there's lots of other folks that serve the niche markets or have a shorter product line or do attachments only or what have you. So they would be more considered minors.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up would be, so for your warranty work, you're basically saying you pay the shop rate, you pay for the parts, pretty straightforward. Do you negotiate a different deal with different dealers, or is that, and I guess you're considered a major, do you do different deals with different dealerships, or is that pretty much your arrangement with
yes.
sellers of your product?
There's a baseline, and then the baseline improves as the dealer meets certain metrics. Are you trained? Have you attended training? Do you have you been schooled in the electronic service tool that allows the dealer to do diagnostics efficiently? Have you invested in the special tools that are required for the new models that have come in? Do you have a parts fill rate that is of a certain strength? So the better the dealer does, the more the dealer is invested, the better service level the dealer gets, the more reimbursement rate he receives from us. And again, I have to preface that by saying that's our policy. I'm not talking for the industry in that regard.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So so these are pretty objective type metrics. So in your business, for example, you don't necessarily micro-negotiate with an independent dealer. Let's say someone from, you know, CMI, I'll use it as an example, calls you up and says, I want a special deal, and if you don't give it to me, I'm going to buy from, you know, Hitachi or Volvo. And then that sort of, in other words, you have a pretty flat deal with all these guys based on the metrics that you just mentioned.
For warranty work and yeah. For service work and that type of thing?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Representative Knopp.
Mr. Whitaker, so I think I'll have two questions for you, sir. First question is, do you reimburse on a flat rate basis? Do you have flat rate manuals that mechanics, or you have an expect, you have a dollar number there you're expecting for a certain repair? Is that fair to say?
Well, we have a flat rate manual.
Okay.
For warranty repairs, and then that will provide, for instance, a job may take 2 hours, and then the dealer will multiply that times their personal shop labor rate plus any additional incentive that we may have given to the dealer.
But you're not paying 4 hours for a two-hour job. Would that be fair to say you'd squawk at that a little bit?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, sir?
Well, if you had something you would flat rate out at 2 hours, you wouldn't pay a dealer reimbursement 4 hours for the same job that you're expecting 2 hours on. Is that fair to say? That's probably...
If the dealer raised an objection and said, listen, I ran into some unusual situation, then he certainly has the ability to appeal and will often make concessions based on that appeal.
Okay.
And if there's nothing special about the operation, then very likely and probably most of the time the dealer would see the 2 hours.
Okay, thank you. And, Mr. Chair, just one last question here, Mr. Whitaker. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about my personal experiences as far as warranty work goes. And so when I have, my skid steer loader breaks down and I go to the dealer I bought it from and tell them my loader's broke, they say, well, bring it in, we'll fix it. That's the first thing they tell me. When I tell them, well, it's not a place I can get it in readily, you can come out and fix it easier than me bringing it in. So at that point, my expectation is to have to pay for that travel time, and that has been how it's always worked for me. They have to come to my job site to fix it, even under warranty. I still end up paying for that component. They're traveling. They don't charge me for the repair, obviously. It's covered under warranty. So that has always been my experience in warranty work. Is that standard practice? I mean, so I guess my question I'm trying to get to in our rural areas, so say we got an excavator in Kotzebue and it needs pretty serious repair, we probably wouldn't expect them to ship that back to the dealer. And if they did, it would be at the owner's expense, or the owner pays to fly the mechanic out there and put them up. Is that how it currently works today, and is it your practice to reimburse them types of expenses or not?
Well, as a general statement, we do not reimburse travel time. We don't reimburse employee lodging and related costs. Again, it's something that if the dealer has a particular compelling reason that we should look at it. We certainly will look at it, and oftentimes we'll react to it, but as a standard, no. But that's also, as I was referring to earlier, part of the dealer's responsibility to, one, understand where the product's going. If it's going into a, you know, a mining situation that was described earlier and very difficult, and, you know, I would, you know, suggest that, you know, Skyjack could have been, should have been consulted about the product and say, you know, is this something you're comfortable placing your product in? But nonetheless, you know, I think part of that is understanding those costs on the part of the dealer and being able to account for those. It's part of the sales price that went into the product when you purchased it.
Mr. Whitaker, wouldn't you say, though, it would also be a consumer's responsibility to understand that going in? I mean, I would sure think about that if I was going to buy a piece and ship it pretty rural. I mean, and I'm pretty sure that the consumer and the dealer must have that conversation, would you not think? And
well, I would think, because I, you know, as I mentioned, in Texas and in North Dakota, I've been part of those conversations, and that's something that it's really incumbent upon the dealer to make sure that he's clearly communicating to the customer that there's some certain expectations that he should have that would be different than if he was in close proximity to a dealer location. So some of that onus does fall on the dealer to make sure that that's clearly understood.
Mr. Whitaker, this conversation has run on quite a long time, but I do have just kind of one comment, and I do know we say things are different in Alaska. In some circumstances, they really are different, and what we do have is a lot of construction that happens in remote parts of the state where a contractor will load up a barge, ship it out in the springtime to a site. That equipment is not coming back until September, or if it's a multi-year job, it stays there. There is not an opportunity to bring that back, and in a lot of cases, contractors won't know which contract they are going to get by bidding, and when they get that bid, they're going to go to whatever location is identified. They can't tell the dealer, I'm taking it to this community or that community or that community. They are a contractor, and they bid on contracts, and they will go where the work is. But if they have a piece of equipment that they put on that barge, it goes out in April, and it fails, then that is affecting the bottom line of that contractor, and they've bought that piece of equipment in good faith. And so I think from the manufacturer's perspective, to understand the fact that some of these smaller contractors don't have the ability to ship up another piece of equipment or to do some major repairs on their own and are reliant on the dealer and the manufacturer to make sure that they have equipment that works so they can do their jobs. So we do have very little road up here for the geography of the state, and we do have a lot of construction that happens in places that are not accessible except by air or water. And so I just wanted to put that out there for you to think about in regard to how the manufacturers consider reimbursement or not for travel or lodging, or how to support the pieces of equipment. And so that's more of a comment from me, and wanted to get that out there on the record. We do have one other invited person, and then I'd like to get to some public testimony before we have to wrap up the meeting. And it is possibly looking like we might not be able to get to House Bill 195, so that one might actually have to be delayed until Monday. But thank you for your testimony, Mr. Whitaker, and we'll go on to Jim Halloran with Caterpillar. Mr. Halloran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Halloran, for the record, Caterpillar Incorporated. I'm down in Sacramento, California. And I, you know, in respect of everyone's Easter weekend and the fine job that Mr. Whitaker did in explaining any number of those provisions in the bill, I'll just keep it to a couple of points, because the name Caterpillar and NC Machinery came up several times in the discussion, and so I just wanted to point out that not only is Caterpillar in opposition here, but we are joined by our dealer, NC Machinery, in that opposition. So I think that makes us a little bit different. Just a few points on that relationship. NC Machinery has been our dealer since 1926. And they are our only dealer. They have five locations throughout the state. And so we look at this a little bit more uniquely based on the fact that we have that existing lifelong generation, couple generation relationship with the dealer. Obviously, NC Machinery has those similar types of relationships with their customers. And so, quite honestly, we see this as a solution looking for a problem, because we're not experiencing these problems that have been raised, and if we are, we're handling in-house through our dealer agreements. Representative Josephson had a comment about dealer agreements, and I can tell you that, as Mr. Whitaker pointed out, we have global agreements, and as I had mentioned in the Senate hearing on this, appreciating the challenges of Alaska and getting into some of the remote areas, these same global agreements that we have in place for Alaska, or the one we have in place for Alaska, is the same one we have in sub-Saharan Africa. And I would argue that we probably see the same amount of challenges getting parts, equipment, service to those customers operating there. Additionally, I think there was a comment made earlier, and maybe it was Representative Birch's line of questioning about, is this going to change how warranties are handled? Yes, it will, very much so. Our agreement is different than CNH, that's different than Volvo or what have you, and yes, this would impact the way we handle our warranties. In terms of out-of-state sales, I guess the logical out-of-state sale for Alaska would either be Canada or Washington State. In our case, NC Machinery also represents Washington State, so it pretty much stays within that geography. You know, I'll just go back to the comment that I started with, and that is, you know, when we talk about these dealer agreements, we have a global dealer agreement with our dealers operating across the globe. This one with NC Machinery, again, has been in place since 1926. I think there was a question on when these dealer agreements get looked at. The last change that we had in our dealer agreements occurred in mid-1970s. These things are working, and I think an earlier comment was made that maybe the legislature is overstepping its bounds in getting involved in these types of agreements, and quite honestly, from a Caterpillar and an NC Machinery standpoint, we would agree with that. So I'd be happy to take any questions. It's pretty much cut and dry, and again, I compliment Mr. Whitaker on his going through the bill as cleanly as he did, and pointed out some of the same concerns that we would have.
Thank you, Mr. Halloran. Questions for Mr. Halloran? Not seeing any questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We are going to open public testimony now on House Bill 209. And we will go in the room. We have David Blummer, who wanted to come forward, and I believe you've got a statement to read. If you can put your name on the record and then indicate who you're presenting for.
My name's David Blummer. I'm here representing Bicknell Incorporated.
Thank you.
The Bicknells have been in Alaska for about 40 years. They've done paving about 15 years. In about 2007, Bicknell Inc. purchased a factory-rebuilt Ingersoll Rand paver for about $225,000. This was one of the last machines in Ingersoll Rand rebuilt before they sold their paving division to Volvo Construction Equipment. After receiving the machine in Juneau, it was obvious there were some problems with it. Bicknell Inc. had several meetings with the local dealer and the manufacturer to try to address the issues. The manufacturer told Bicknell to deal with issues through normal warranty procedures. Unfortunately, those normal warranty procedures didn't cover some of the things we've discussed already. Travel labor when the machine broke down on the job, air freighting in the parts when the machine was down but we needed to pave to avoid liquidated damages, trucking our paver back to the dealer in order to get it worked on, renting another paver to complete the jobs. On top of this, when Bicknell Inc. sold the paver in 2002, we were not able to get full market value for this paver because, as you know, Juneau's a small town and it was already labeled as what some would call a lemon. HB 209 would have helped reduce some of the costs associated with the warranty work performed on the paver. It still would not have covered most of the costs incurred that were associated with the downtime. It would have also given Bicknell Inc. The ability to return the paver under the Lemon Law provision. For these reasons, Bicknell Inc. Asks you to support HB 209.
Thank you, Mr. Bulmer. Any questions?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Justison.
Through the chair, I guess my main question would be about whether you exercised. First of all, I'm sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay, but. Whether you exercised sufficient due diligence in reading the agreement, I could see a situation where, because of a compelling need, one might sort of speed through that. And, I mean, did you find anything? The key for me is, did you find anything in the agreement that they just violated? They said they would do something, and they just didn't.
I'm here representing the owner, Roscoe Bicknell. So. I'm not really able to comment on that because I don't know the specifics on the agreement. So I apologize for that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Roller.
Yep.
Testimony. We have Chris Girondale. Thank you, Chris.
Hi, Chris Girondale. I am here as a contract employee for Channel Construction, who is a local dealer. I do also work part-time for Construction Machinery as well. And do some work for Kensington and Greens Creek Mine as well. Channel Construction, Will Tonsgaard, who's the Vice President of Channel Construction, was going to testify, but there happens to be a barge in town today, so I'm reading Will's testimony. I, Will Tonsgaard of Juneau, Alaska, ask you to support HB 209. I am Vice President of Channel Construction in Juneau, Alaska, and I'm speaking on behalf of my father, William Shorty Tonsgaard Jr., who is President of Channel Construction, and myself. We had not originally intended on getting involved in this discussion because I was concerned about how this may affect our support from Caterpillar going forward. After I heard they testified in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee that they didn't have these problems, I became frustrated and angry because we have had many problems with getting Caterpillar and other manufacturers as well to stand behind the equipment they manufactured for many years. While we have had problems with many manufacturers, I will provide one example from our experience with Caterpillar and can provide more examples if you feel it would be helpful. Channel Construction purchased two new Caterpillar excavators. Since they were new, the excavators would turn to the left when driven. Numerous times we've had Caterpillar and their local dealer try to fix these machines, but they could never fix the problems. We paid NC Machinery, the local Cat dealer, well over $10,000 to try to fix the excavators, but they still can't figure out the problems to this day. We still own and use these excavators every week, even though they pull to the left, because we are a small company and can't afford to replace these machines, even though this issue affects our operation. These are specialized pieces of equipment that would cost us well over $1 million to replace, and we don't have that kind of money. We do a lot of demolition and work on barges. Although we have never had an accident due to this problem, it is a potential safety issue and could cause problems at some point. It is my understanding that House Bill 209 would have helped alleviate some of the costs associated with these work orders and allowed us to get these machines replaced under the Lemon Law feature of House Bill 209 when we first purchased these machines. We are just a small family-owned construction company and don't have the administrative staff to fight with big manufacturers when things aren't going the way they should. This bill will help small companies like ours have some leverage in getting our equipment fixed when it doesn't work as designed. I can give you other examples where I feel manufacturers other than Cat have not supported small companies like ours when it comes to warranties and technical service bulletins. Will Tonsgaard III, Vice President, Channel Construction.
Thank you, Mr. Girondale. We have questions. Representative Knopp and then Representative Wolf.
Well, I guess my first question will be, since you're reading the statement for the owner, are you familiar with the whole situation, what happened before I ask you any questions?
I am fairly familiar. I do work for them on a weekly basis.
Well, I guess my question would be, so if NC wasn't able to fix the problem, is it because their maintenance support staff wasn't adequate or manufacturer wasn't providing what they needed? I guess where I'm going is, why is it the manufacturer's responsibility? Were they not fulfilling their obligation? I mean, and so was the dealer.
So the manufacturer sold a piece of equipment that it is designed and explained when you push both pedals forward, it will drive forward in a straight line. You push both pedals forward, and it turns to the left. It's a safety issue operating on barge. So why it does that, we don't know. That's why we hired the experts to come out and fix it. And several times they've been out. There's well over – there were, I think – there were at least five work orders that I found from them coming out trying to fix this problem. And they're just not sure what the problem is with it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative Wolf.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is along the same lines in that there was stated earlier there's no direct sales from manufacturers to individuals. They all go through a dealer, in this case NC. So why isn't your gripe with NC, who's been in business with Caterpillar since 19-something?
76, I think they said.
26, yeah.
Oh, 26.
Yeah, a long time. So obviously they have a good relationship. And, you know, if I have a problem with a Ford, I buy at the Ford dealer, I'm going to deal with them to the extent that I can, I guess. And maybe NC just put up a fence or something. And I don't know, I mean, you bought two machines. I'm assuming it's a big investment. So I would think they would sort of be liable on the hook for it.
So I mean, NC Machinery is absolutely who we go through to deal with these problems. The as far as I don't – the lemon law provision of it to try to get in some different excavators that wouldn't pull to the left – I don't know. My understanding is that typically that isn't handled through the dealer. It is handled through the manufacturer. That's how the automobile law in Alaska is, the boat law in Alaska, and the ATV law, is that the lemon law is through the manufacturer. But I'm not sure of that.
Okay. Thank you. Quick follow-up while he's talking. So you are – it's not a coincidence you have the same last name.
Absolutely not. Okay. And as I said, I do work for Construction Machinery as
okay,
well.
Okay, I just – absolutely. Same family. Okay, gotcha. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Gerondo.
Thank you.
And we have Stephen Seward, Construction Machinery Industrial out of Anchorage. Mr. Seward, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, or are you just available for questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm just available for questions.
Okay, thank you. We have Nick Yaksich, Association of Equipment Manufacturers. Mr. Yaksich, can you place your name and affiliation on the record? Begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nick Yaksich. I'm the Senior Vice President, Government and Industry Affairs for the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. AEM represents, is a North America-based international trade association representing over 950 companies in the off-highway machinery market. Just in the interest of time, let me just summarize our concerns, which have been expressed in a letter, and we'd be happy to follow up with further discussions. AEM is opposed to HB 209, which would alter the treatment of heavy equipment warranties. We believe fundamentally that it is an intrusion into the business relationship between the manufacturer and the dealer. Our hope and what we work with is that these issues are dealt with outside of the legal or the legislative arena, and that between the customer, the dealer, and the manufacturer, that these issues can be resolved. There's been discussions on contracts. These contracts are put in place between manufacturers, both major manufacturers, and we also represent smaller manufacturers as well, too. Ultimately, is customers and manufacturers are looking to protect their brand and provide the best technology, the best service to the dealer and to the customer. And so just in closing, we would oppose this bill, and it would have a significant impact on all manufacturers. And thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Yaksich. And I've got a question from myself, and that is, as you are working around the country, are there other states that have laws that provide some direction on warranty in other states that you have to deal with?
We haven't recently, through the chair, we have not dealt with this issue recently on the warranty. I mean, the contracts are extensive in terms of buybacks, warranty, parts, and such. but in this case, we have not dealt with the warranty issues.
Well, thank you. And just kind of a follow-up, and you had hopefully heard my comments earlier, just to be aware and sensitive to the fact that we do have a unique construction situation here in Alaska, where I do say everybody says we are unique in this situation we are, where equipment is transported to construction sites and not easily accessible to the road system or dealers. And that's just one of those things that I think is fairly unique, at least in our country. There are remote areas, but I do think we have some transportation challenges here that many other places don't. And we also have a limited construction season that makes it vitally important to be able to have equipment that is functioning when it needs to be functioning. And so just keeping that in mind for the manufacturers to be aware, we have restrictions, limitations on time frames here that are different than might be situations in other states.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I should also comment, too, on the issue that was raised earlier on the Tier 4, I think is a good example. It was EPA mandated as part of the Clean Air Act. Manufacturers spent millions of dollars in research and development to bring and to comply with that EPA mandate. So it's an example of a kind of a challenge that we also face working with the customer and complying with the law. So it's a challenge that we work together with the customer and the dealer and the manufacturer.
Thank you, Mr. Yaksik. Any other questions? Not seeing any questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we have Curtis Thayer, Alaska Chamber. Mr. Thayer, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the president and CEO of the Alaska Chamber of Commerce. We represent over 700 businesses, manufacturers, and local chambers across the state, and we support the current version of HB 209, an act related to product warranties. You know, we've discussed, and I've heard the testimony about the remoteness of Alaska and the high cost of shipping in Alaska, and this is one of the, these are one of the challenging things we have by living here. But one thing that we do need to do is look out for our dealers here in Alaska. This bill is modeled after other laws in other states for warranties, and we need to have a bill that extends the same protection to the heavy equipment that keeps Alaska's construction and resource industries active and alive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. We do have a question for you, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Mr. Thayer, is the United States Chamber of Commerce's position on these sorts of bills the same as the state's chamber?
We are not. We are affiliated through a federation with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but we are not a part of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Thayer? Thank you, Mr. Thayer, for your testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
I do not have anybody else online for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide additional public testimony? Not looking like it. Seeing none, we will close public testimony for now. And what I'm going to do is we will set this bill aside and bring it back before us at some point in the future. And I do know there have been some conversations. So we've got the technical end of session on Sunday, and this is technically our last official meeting, although we have announced meetings for next week. And so we are scheduled for Monday through Friday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday next week. We don't know what's going to happen, so we're just going to keep going as if we don't have any changes until somebody tells us we have changes. But we will at some point celebrate completion of our committee work. I'm just not exactly sure when. So appreciate everyone coming here, and we do have meetings next week. We will be addressing some of the bills before us, and hopefully we'll be able to make some further progress and think about getting close to closing the committee out. Appreciate everyone coming, and we will adjourn at 4:47 p.m. Thank you.